This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 17th episode. Today, we tackle another article from the JCENM, this one introducing a new framework to help us evaluate the effectiveness of pituitary surgeries. We sometimes struggle with presenting the risk and benefits of surgical intervention to our patients with functional pituitary adenomas, and this study proposes a new paradigm to help with that. Though we will look at the methodology of this observational study, the paper focuses on a new way to assess surgical outcomes, so we too will focus on how the authors present their results. For this episode, I am again joined by an international group of endocrinologists, as we have been lucky enough to have for a few of our episodes, the Endocrine Feedback Loop. As a reminder, I'm a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm the medical director of our outpatient clinic and one of the associate directors for our fellowship program. Joining me again today as one of our regular contributors is Katie Gutenberg. She hails from the University of Texas at Houston, where she is the director for their endocrinology fellowship and an associate director for their internal medicine residency. Her clinical focus is pituitary disease, and she's a well-known endocrine educator both at her institution and nationally through the Endocrine Society. Our guest expert today is Ashley Grossman from the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom. He is one of the world's experts in hypothalamic and pituitary tumors with numerous publications, presentations, and leadership positions testifying to that expertise. So I have with me today the perfect pair of endocrinologists to help understand a paper on pituitary tumors. Also, as usual, everything we say is our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Our article today is Outcome Squares, Integrating Efficacy and Safety as Applied to Functioning Pituitary Adenoma Surgery. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in its September 2021 edition with Friso de Vries from Leiden University in the Netherlands as the first author. Katie will now walk us through the introduction of their paper, and she and Ashley will also review for us key aspects of pituitary surgery in general. Katie, why don't you take it away?
Thank you, Chase. So as we know, transsphenoidal surgery is typically first-line treatment for patients with Cushing's disease and acromegaly, and this study specifically focuses on hormone-secreting pituitary tumors. Outcomes are typically reported in a clinician-centered fashion, so focusing on measures of efficacy like remission rates or gross total resection, and secondarily on complications. The authors practiced in a high-volume tertiary referral center and developed a care pathway based on a value-based healthcare model. So what does that mean? A value-based healthcare model integrates clinician and patient-reported outcomes, offering a more holistic view that may be more meaningful to patients. This included a prospective collection of clinician and patient-reported outcomes, as well as individualized preoperative counseling. Results are not always easily summarized because patients present with variable clinical manifestations, severity of hormone excess, tumor size, extension, and preoperative pituitary function. So I think I'll hand it over to Ashley. Maybe you can comment a little bit about why summarizing pituitary disease can be so challenging.
It can be difficult because I wear a number of different hats. One of them is pituitary disease, another is neuroendocrine tumors, the latter being a lot more malignant and progressive. But with pituitary tumors, on the whole, you're looking, although there are occasional patients with severe symptoms like visual loss, quality of life, and the implications for their lifestyle, their replacement therapy, and their general ambience. So it's often quite difficult to make a judgment call as to whether a given treatment is indicated and whether any advantages of the treatment are matched or hopefully much less in terms of possible adverse effects. So you've got to look at that. You've got to look at it in an overall sort of holistic perspective. And that can be quite complex, particularly if the patient themselves has their own background feelings they're going to bring to this. And you end up having quite a complex discussion in most cases.
The field is largely lacking in randomized controlled trials, and so we're often using observational data to make some of the treatment recommendations for our patients. And so the objective of this study was to propose a novel way to classify and report outcomes, integrating efficacy and safety at the patient level. And I will hand it over to Chase to walk us through the method session.
Great, Katie. Thank you for that overview. And as I mentioned before, this episode will be a little bit different. We typically, when we go through the methods, spend a great amount of time understanding the study design, and we will talk about it briefly here. But the emphasis of this paper isn't really the results that they are presenting, but how they are presenting the results. So it'll be a little bit different here. But let's still start, as we normally do, with the methods of thinking about the study design in general, because I do think it is helpful to have that framework as we at least look at the data that they present. So there data best fits as a retrospective cohort study. So the way that cohort studies work, they're observational studies, and you have at least two groups. And generally speaking, you have something that you would label as an exposure. We'll come to that in this situation because it may be a little bit unusual to think about that. But you have one group that is exposed to something, and then you have another group that is unexposed to that. And then you follow those people over time. So the following over time is a key component that makes it a cohort study. And then you look for variable outcomes to see if your unexposed or exposed group has the outcome more than the other. And that's what makes it a cohort study. It being a retrospective study is when you started the investigation. So if you started this study after all of your data was collected, if you're looking back at data that exists in a database or in your clinical records, then it's retrospective. It's a prospective study if you designed your study and made all the plans before you even saw the subjects who would be a part of the study. So the fact that this is all data that they're looking back and collecting would make it best fit as a retrospective cohort study. So we'll think about that. We'll come back to that as we describe a little bit more about the data that these authors are presenting. So the way the authors describe the work that they did in this investigation, that they did a retrospective chart review of all of the patients, and that's 198 patients, that underwent a fully endoscopic transphenoidal pituitary surgery, and that's between January 1st, 2010, and December 31st of 2018, so 18 years here. And they included surgeries for acromegaly, Cushing's disease, and prolactinomas. And the way that they split these groups is they compare these, the way they made their cohorts is whether this was before or after the implementation of this value-based healthcare pituitary care pathway. So they've abbreviated the value-based healthcare VBHC, and so we'll use that terminology here. There were several different things. Katie has mentioned a few of them already, and we'll come back to what those included, but there were several different interventions, if you want to think about it that way, that would lead to the group after the intervention of that pathway in 2016 being considered the exposed group. They were exposed to this new pathway as opposed to the previous group that was unexposed to that pathway. There are other things that changed over that time period, so we're going to come to those because it's not quite as simple as that, but that's the basic framework of what makes this a retrospective cohort study and sets up how they're going to present their results. So before we go further, though, we wanted to get Ashley's thoughts here as we were looking at this paper in advance and discussing some of the key points. Ashley had raised concerns that, well, they have functional pituitary tumors here, though that's actually not all of the pituitary tumors that we're seeing. We're leaving out a large subsection of the population that we care for here in non-functional tumors. So Ashley, what are your thoughts on why maybe that was left out, and would that have an impact on the results that we see here?
Maybe it's unfair criticizing the group or commenting on the group on things they didn't do, because if that's not what they set out to do. But it's certainly true that when you've got the functioning tumors, it's much more easy to assess how effective your treatments are. You have hormone measurements, we're endocrinologists, we love measuring things. When you've got a non-functioning adenoma, on the whole, you're looking for more imaging characteristics, and the adverse events are going to be more obvious because you can often but lose things. So I think that's maybe a criticism, because that's what most of the tumors that come across to most pituitary surgeons are indeed. However, putting that to one side, I think I see what you're saying in terms of the analysis of the group, but it's not that they were really looking at the results as to show the results or change therapy, but how to present data so that they can be compared within a department, between departments, between countries. And I think it's only fair to say that this very excellent group were not showing how very clever they were at whatever their treatments happened to be, but this is a way of presenting their data which they find useful and that they're trying to expand to other groups. And I think from that point of view, even though it's a retrospective cohort study, that can be really quite useful and it's something worth discussing as to how helpful that's going to be to all of us.
And I think that raises a good point, is that the authors have separately published on the effectiveness of their pathway. So we will look at those numbers. But again, the point actually of this paper is not to say what their numbers are and whether this new pathway is effective or ineffective. We'll look at those, but it's really just a way of presenting different results. And so, yeah, so we'll certainly keep that in mind. But their results, a much more in-depth analysis of actually the effectiveness of this is available elsewhere, because they certainly have considered that closely. Good. So now let's go back to, again, just a little bit, even though it's not the emphasis, we do want to at least talk about the basics of the evaluation, because this is, as an excellent group, is a very standardized way of approaching these patients. So we wanted to go through that. So quickly, at the preoperative assessment for all of these individuals, they all had MRI and CT imaging. And the way they classified the tumors is based on the size. This is pretty standard. So the typical micro, macro, whether it was under or over a centimeter in diameter. They also added an additional description if it's a giant adenoma, so if it was 4 centimeters or greater. Also, we're looking on all this imaging for evidence of cavernous sinus invasion and scored that as well. All of these individuals had a full endocrine assessment, and that is looking both for evidence of hypo or obviously hyperfunctioning, since all of these surgeries were for individuals who had hyperfunctioning pituitary tumors. And they also all had ophthalmologic assessment, both for, at a minimum, acuity and perimetry testing that they performed, all of this preoperatively. And then, as a part of this evaluation, all of these individuals, all of these patients were seen at a combined endocrinology neurosurgery clinic. And that's a part of the personalized consultation and surgical planning was made. And part of it, and this has been alluded to already by Katie and Ashley, but there were lots of complicated decisions that were made there. And part of it, which we'll get to in a second, is what is the goal of this surgery? Is total resection of the pituitary tumor realistic and is the goal of this surgery? Or is it really debulking is the most realistic goal that can be set here? But before we move on past that, though, I thought it would be helpful. Many of us work in these types of clinics, but they do function differently from center to center, and many of us don't have the opportunity to work in these clinics. So we thought it would be helpful for Ashley, who has a long experience with these sorts of centers and clinics, to describe in general how these multidisciplinary teams work, different models that he has encountered, and how they come to a decision on the care that they're going to provide.
I think that's a very important point, and I think we'll probably come to this later on, but all of us, I believe, are moving very much towards centers of excellence so that you have a smaller number of highly experienced pituitary surgeons working in a group. And I've seen two models, one in London, one in Oxford, but there are, you know, various other ones. The model we originally had in London was we had our multidisciplinary team. That's going to be an endocrinologist, obviously the neurosurgeon, a nurse who is very important in terms of liaison, ideally a coordinator who will pull it all together and form any documentation as necessary, sometimes a radiotherapist, an oncologist, and various other people who can be added. But in the original group that we had, we would meet up, and the critical point, although it's slightly glossed over in this paper, is not what are the possible side effects or outcomes of surgery, but who should be offered surgery in the first place. And I think the tool they're offering, and we'll return to that, is one that you can then use in making that decision. So at the MDT, that will all be discussed, the various options will be considered, and then in the original plan, the nominated consultant specialist will then return and have a one-to-one consultation with the patient. Now, the alternative scheme, the one I experienced in Oxford, which has also merits and dismerits, is that the patient is present. In other words, you have a group meeting, again, with the endocrinologist, a senior nurse, the neurosurgeon, maybe other junior trainees, with the patient who has been forewarned, and that discussion therefore takes place in a group, and that's concluded with the patient present. Now, the advantages of that is obviously speed. The patient can ask their questions with the whole group present, and I think the patient becomes aware that this is a group decision-making process. They often appreciate that. A slight downside, and it depends on the sophistication of the patient, is that it can be quite intimidating, as it were. You have the one patient and maybe half a dozen medical specialists around them. So there's pros and cons. On the whole, I found that having the patient present in an active discussion was actually extremely helpful. It meant when the patient left the room, all of the pros and cons had been gone through. You had made a decision in the presence of the patient, and things moved on very quickly.
And before we move on too far past that, so the authors mentioned that with their operative technique, that in particular, that all these surgeries were performed by two experienced pituitary neurosurgeons. So comment on us, actually, on the literature, what it tells us about the success of surgeries and the complications of surgeries, particularly as related to the experience of the surgeon performing.
Oh, very much. This has become absolutely critical, partly driven by, I think, endocrinologists, dare one say it, and partly from patient involvement and the internet and the patient sophistication. There is absolutely no doubt that the more operations a surgeon has done and the more they do per annum, the better the outcomes. And that comes out time and time again. So increasingly, we are trying to focus the groups of pituitary surgeons into a small number of centers with high expertise. And if you're not doing, say, at least 25, preferably at least 50 pituitary operations a year, then the patients themselves will start voting with their feet. The other aspect is particularly difficult operations like Cushing's disease. If you're not doing at least 6, probably 12 a year, again, these are difficult operations and require a lot of expertise. And it's not so much microscopic versus endoscopic, although all new surgeons are endoscopic. It's a question of simple experience. So a really good microscopic surgeon will give you good results, just like an endoscopic surgeon, but it's the numbers and the expertise. So that is has become absolutely critical. And we've probably reached a plateau at a stage where the most excellent pituitary surgeons have reached a certain point. And I think everyone should aim to do that. And the time for, I've done 2 or 3 last year, I think I can manage this, is really long past.
Good. So another word on this post-operative assessment that the authors use here. So they, as was mentioned before, in 2016, they introduced this pituitary care pathway. Some of the components of that were mentioned already. So Katie mentioned some of that in her introduction, but part of it was individualized preoperative counseling. We'll talk a little bit about some of that preoperative counseling here in a second. But part of the goal of this pathway was a faster discharge, but that was coupled with, after that discharge, having that case manager that Ashley mentioned many of these centers have, had daily contact with these patients at home all the way up through post-operative day 14. So this would be interesting, again, is if we were really closely assessing the results here, if that was the focus of this paper, I would say we'd want to be really cautious with this, because this would introduce the possibility of an ascertainment bias. Whenever you have a cohort study, what you want to try to understand in terms of a bias is if one group was treated differently than the other, and in particular, an ascertainment bias is, are you looking for potential outcomes differently in one group versus the other? It was designed to do this, so this wasn't an accidental thing that was done, but potentially then if you had somebody who was calling a patient every single day, when in the past maybe that person went home and they only called you if they were doing very poorly, but you could potentially introduce new findings here, new outcomes, and actually discover that there were more complications in the situation purely because you were looking more for them, not because they were actually occurring. So again, not the emphasis here, but as we look at the results, we'll want to look at those complications, in particular those ones that show up in that first month after surgery, and see if it could be possible that there are more showing up purely because the clinic is looking for them, not necessarily because they're occurring more. So just something to think about. Okay, final couple things here is, as a part of this post-operative assessment, they always followed up in this combined endocrinology neurosurgery clinic 6 weeks and 6 months after surgery, and then had an MRI 6 months after surgery. So a few other words here about the efficacy parameters, and this is where we get into some of the unique aspects of the way the authors conducted their investigation, is the main thing that they were interested in, the main efficacy parameter was biochemical remission. But as far as the preoperative counseling, they wanted to very clearly delineate what is the intended effect of the surgery. And they put that into three different groups. They further combine those here in a second, but their groups, first of all, group one is this is an individual that is realistic to say that we think we can safely do a complete surgical tumor resection and that biochemical remission is likely here and can be pursued. So that's group one. Group two is individuals, it's similar, but it's where a complete resection is possible, but you don't know for sure that it's realistic. So for example, I actually mentioned Cushing's disease before, so potentially a really small tumor, maybe it's not seen on cross-sectional imaging, so maybe if you can find it during the surgery, you can remove it, but you're not always sure exactly where that's going to be. Another example the authors use is cavernous sinus invasion. A lot of that's going to depend upon what the surgeon sees during the surgery. That's hard to determine up front how likely a total cure is. Group three is a very different group, and that is a group to where preoperatively it's very clear remission is not possible. And the goal in that situation is tumor debulking. And so they were really trying to be clear about what we are hoping to accomplish in these surgeries. So the way that they then combine these a little bit is groups one and two, they combined into a group where they said that the surgical goal is achievement of remission, where group three is very different and that they are doing surgery for different reasons. And the authors here list a host of reasons, several of them we've mentioned already. So trying to prevent loss of visual acuity being one example, but actually give us just another word on that. So when you've got somebody who's got a huge tumor, whether it's functioning or non-functioning, how do you decide when you're going to intervene in these folks when it's very unrealistic that total surgical cure will be accomplished?
There's absolutely no doubt. The first thing you really want to do is preserve vision, and that sine qua non, this is the central first point. Assuming it's maybe abutting the chiasm or a few millimeters away, then really what you're aiming to do is to debulk sufficient tumor, A, to allow medical therapy to become more effective. For example, if you've got a very high cortisol level with Cushing's disease and a macroadenoma, which is uncommon, about 7% of Cushing's disease, then by debulking the tumor, it is possible that it will be more responsive to a pituitary effective drug. And we certainly know for acromegaly that when you debulk a tumor, you lower the mean level of growth hormone and IGF-1, and you're more likely to get a response to a somatostatin analog. So there are those two features. And the third one, I suppose, is if you've got a particularly aggressive tumor, then it's usually advisable to debulk as far as possible if you're considering external beam radiotherapy or radiosurgery. So all these are quite reasonable. Finally, if you've got a non-functioning tumor, where clearly hormonal problems, parameters are not going to be paramount, even if it's not causing a visual defect, there may sometimes be a case of saying, I will lower it sufficiently or remove sufficient tumor, so I now have time over maybe years to see whether or not there is going to be continuing stability of the tumor. Whereas if it's near the chiasm, there's always a concern that the patient may start losing vision, which may become irreversible. So there are a whole number of different features. But I think this just brings us back to my very original point, is that sometimes the question is not looking simply what are the outcomes of surgery, but this very, very long, sometimes and difficult discussion as to who should be offered surgery in the first place.
A few other words here. So as far as potential adverse outcomes, so first of all, the authors use a couple of different descriptions, terminology here. So one is a complication, and they define complication as something that shows up in the first 30 days after the operation that requires medical intervention. And I think probably the best example of this would be transient diabetes insipidus. And I would say, as an aside, this is the best situation, best example of where an ascertainment bias could show up, because possibly with the old situation where they maybe kept patients a little bit longer in the hospital, but then sent them home without any necessarily plan to contact the patient proactively and said, call us if you need us, that maybe patient has transient DI at home, but it's not bad enough, or they just deal with it and they never contact the clinic. So that's an unknown complication, as opposed to this new pathway to where they have the case manager calling every day for 2 weeks that maybe you pick up on this. So that would be a potential area that we would want to look for in these results. As far as an adverse effect, they define that as a long-term complication. So it has to be present for more than 6 months after surgery. And examples of that would be new onset, permanent hypopituitarism, neurologic deficits, anosmia, and death would certainly be included there. Now we're going to get on to this new paradigm that the authors introduce, and this is where we're going to spend our time thinking about it. And these are what they are describing as outcome squares. So if you want to envision this in your head as a large square that's divided into four quadrants, and they define these quadrants differently, and every outcome could be put in one of these four quadrants. So first of all, in quadrant one, this is where we want all of our patients to end up in. So this is a quadrant to where remission was achieved, or at least whatever that surgical outcome was, if it was an actual remission, that you achieved that and that no complication occurred. So that's the ideal scenario, is this first quadrant. The fourth quadrant is the one that we really, really want to avoid. That's where you didn't get remission, or you didn't accomplish your surgical outcome and you had a complication. So that's the worst. But then they also had a couple of intermediate outcome categories. This is quadrant two and quadrant three. So first of all, quadrant two, that is the group to where you achieved remission. You met your goal, but you had a complication. And then quadrant three is actually would be the opposite of that. It's where you didn't achieve your goal, but you didn't have a complication of the surgery. So both of those that they lump together as an intermediate outcome. And what I wanted us to talk about for a little bit, and I'll rope Katie in here to get her thoughts on this, and Ashley as well, but thinking about that, in the discussion, we're going to get to the author's argument of why they needed to do so much lumping, but I just wanted to, just for sake of argument, say, well, do we really think that particularly quadrants two and quadrant three, that we would lump together as intermediate? So just to play devil's advocate here, if you wanted to come up with a scenario of, say, well, maybe you had somebody who had Cushing's disease, and they were quadrant two. So maybe you cured them with the surgery, but they got permanent DI, but it's really easily controlled. They take DDAVP at night and do great with that and have no problems. Versus somebody who's got terrible acromegaly and you tried to help with that with surgery, but you didn't really accomplish anything. You didn't have a complication, but you didn't improve anything with that surgery. Would that really be considered the same and put that lump that together as far as an intermediate outcome? So, Katie, maybe let's get your thoughts on that, and then Ashley as well. How do you think about that lumping of patients together?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, I do think it's important to look at those two groups separately because they do have very different care pathways after treatments. I mean, you make a great point that if we're having, you know, a patient with acromegaly or Cushing's disease, if we retrieve remission, even if we have a poor outcome like new onset hypopituitarism, I would still think that that would be a good outcome for the patient. Whereas if you have a patient that did not have a remission, but did not have a complication, those are patients that are going to need additional treatment. So they're patients that are likely going to need either medication or maybe radiation therapy, or maybe even talking about an additional surgery.
Ashley, thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the authors, you know, they're in a difficult place. Clearly, they want a reasonably simple system that's not too complex that we can all use. And to be fair, they did show in their squares, although they were shown in rather complex tables, different results for acromegaly, Cushing's disease, prolactinomas, etc. But of course, it's really quite different if you've got a 25-year-old woman with Cushing's disease who may be cured of her surgery but is rendered gonadotrophin deficient, as opposed to a 75-year-old who is rendered hypopituitary, who may or may not have been cured of their Cushing's disease. So all of these other parameters are really excluded. But if you put them all in, then it becomes unwieldy. So I think it is useful insofar as it is a little simplistic, but at least it gives you some fairly straightforward measurement that you can guide your treatment over time. And just to come back to your whole concept of the ascertainment bias, I didn't read the paper as one in which they were saying, this is our new system, it's wonderful, we're showing you how good it is. I read it very much that this is our new intensive system, and we've now got an audit tool that we can see over time whether or not the way we operate the system is optimal. It might not be necessary to phone the patient every single day. It might be better if they say 72 rather than 24 hours, but at least you've got a rough and ready tool to estimate over time rather than simply say this looks a good idea.
Exactly. And Ashley points a good one. And again, we want to emphasize that. Well, we are looking at these results. And in a second, Katie's going to walk us through their numbers. Definitely not the point of this paper. It just is a starting ground to talk about how to present results, not actually what they are. So definitely want to keep that in mind, even though we are going to tease that out just a little bit, because I do think it is of interest for folks to hear. And we're going to come back to these outcome squares. So we'll think about it more. The authors do a good job of explaining why they do this lumping. So we'll think about that a little bit more, and particularly what our thoughts are on that before we wrap up. So one final word on the methodology here is that the authors did do a quality of life assessment in a subset of these individuals. So 41 patients had that and are included in their results here. So now we're going to turn it over to Katie. So again, she's going to present a fairly high-level view of the actual numerical data here, but then we're going to spend more time in thinking about this outcome squares and how patients are presented in terms of the results with this new paradigm. So Katie, why don't you walk us through the results?
All right, thank you. So as stated, the study included 198 operations. And when we look at our three big patient populations, the numbers were pretty equally distributed. So about a third of the patients underwent surgery for treatment of acromegaly, about a third underwent treatment for Cushing's disease, and then the remaining patients had surgery for treatment of a prolactinoma. And of those patients, the majority elected to have surgery because they had an intolerance or an inability to take a dopamine agonist. Looking at the goal of surgery, in the majority of cases, the goal was to achieve a biochemical remission, and a much smaller proportion, about 20% of cases, the goal was a debulking of the tumor. The primary outcome was looking at remission rates, and the majority of patients did achieve a biochemical remission. And those numbers did increase before compared to after the implementation of the pituitary care pathway. So about those numbers increased from about 55% of patients to about 70% of patients who achieved a biochemical remission. Now, the authors do point out that there was a threefold increase in their surgical volume during the study period, and then specifically state, kind of getting back to Ashley's point earlier, that they hit sort of that magic number of at least 50 surgeries per year starting in 2015. So I'll let Ashley kind of comment on that in terms of how that may have influenced these results.
As I pointed out before, although I think it's a really interesting study, I do not think the introduction of their care pathway has necessarily been justified. There's increasing number of patients, the surgeons become increasingly skilled at what they're doing, consensus guidelines change over time. So I think the change, the temporal order effect, it may be just as important as the change in their management plan. So in terms of should we be investigating and following patients up in this particular way, it all sounds totally reasonable and it's what many of us do, but I don't think this paper as such actually justifies that approach. It's much more how can we gauge the effectiveness of this approach in the future.
So moving on to complication rates. So again, they're looking at complication rates in two big groups. So the first group is short-term complication rates, and that included things like transient DI, which occurred in about 40% of patients, and then long-term complications that would include things like new onset permanent hypopituitarism that occurred in about 6% of patients. And there was not a decrease in complication rates after implementation of the pituitary care pathway. So, which I think is a little bit interesting, especially since there was an increase in the expertise of the surgeries during the study period. I don't know, Chase, if you want to kind of comment on that.
Yeah, so again, kind of the same issue here. This is where I'd be interested, again, not the point of the study, but I think it's interesting to think about, is this is where an ascertainment bias could show up, because you could potentially actually see more complications show up only because you're looking at them more. So I think the fact that it didn't change, maybe it was offset, you were looking more, but the surgeons were better, who knows? Well, I think the biggest thing you'd be worried about is if complications increase. That would be the obvious red flag of we're getting people out of the hospital too soon, or we're, our approach isn't working. So I think that would be the biggest thing you'd want to make sure that didn't happen. Otherwise, you have to caveat the results significantly. So obviously encouraging that for whatever reason, their remission rates improved and their complications did not go up with this new pathway. So I think that's the main thing, even if we're not exactly sure what it was that was driving that.
Can I also say that, for example, in my old Centre in Oxford. I met up with a surgeon the other day, and they had now changed from 3 to 4 day admission to a 24-hour admission, which I think many people are doing. And if they had been able to use this audit tool, it would have been really quite interesting to follow over the previous 12 months and the following 12 months to get some sort of feeling as to how effective this was, whether there was a change in complications, etc. But again, this ascertainment bias when you're phoning patients every single day, as opposed to discharging them at, say, 48 hours and then maybe phoning them a week or two later. Clearly, it's a very different situation. They're four square, no cure, bad complications. For most of them, I think for the Cushing's disease, it was about 2 patients. So are you getting that much more information actually by using this tool as opposed to saying, well, my patients are doing very well?
So moving on, the real kind of crust of this study is looking at the outcome squares. And so they use 2 different models. Outcome squares integrating remission status and adverse effect, and then outcome squares integrating intended effect and adverse effect. So I'm going to start with the first one, outcome squares integrating remission status and adverse effect. And as Chase stated previously, they look at 3 big groups. 1 is good outcome, 2 intermediate outcome, and then 3 poor outcomes. So starting with good outcomes, the vast majority of patients in the study did have a good outcome, meaning they achieved a biochemical remission without a complication. And kind of as you would expect, this was highest in patients that had microprolactinomas and a bit lower in patients who had acromegaly or Cushing's disease. The next category is the intermediate outcome, and we'll break that down into the 2 kind of subgroups that they look at. So the first subgroup is no remission, but no adverse effect. And that was the majority of patients. The majority of patients who had an intermediate outcome did not achieve remission, but did not have an adverse effect. And then a much smaller number of patients achieved remission with permanent hypopituitarism. And again, the pattern is a little bit what I think what you would expect it to be. So this pattern of intermediate outcome was more prevalent in patients with acromegaly and least prevalent in patients with prolactinomas. And then fortunately, only a small number of patients had a poor outcome, which was no remission with a complication. The second way that they approached this was the outcome squares integrating intended effect and adverse effect. And so here we're looking at the patients a little bit more broadly. So when you're talking about intended effect, that could include things like restoration of vision, tumor debulking to facilitate medical management, or radiation therapy. Again, they use the same 3 big categories, good outcome, intermediate outcome, poor outcome. And again, the vast majority of patients did achieve a good outcome, meaning the intended effect of surgery was achieved without an adverse effect. This number did increase from about 60% to about 75% when intended effect of surgery was applied instead of remission. And so I kind of ask you to comment on this. I think this is an important point when we're talking a little bit more broadly in terms of what the goals of surgery are, either at the patient care level or potentially for research purposes.
That's a good point. When you discuss this with the patient, I think it brings out the fact that you always emphasize the possibility that there may not be surgical cure and the possibility and the significance of any adverse events and complications. The complications, other than the single death in the series, were really fairly trivial. And one often warns patients about transient DI, maybe SIADH at days 7 to 10, which are, for the most part, predictable and manageable and not a problem. And that's almost to be expected within this type of surgery. But the complications are the ones which are, in a sense, much more significant, and although rare and very few, fortunately, in this series with very competent team, are the ones that the patients need to be very much aware of when they make the decision, because clearly the decision is eventually made in collaboration with the patient themselves. So I think that this sense of this is what we intend these are the possible outcomes, and we think this is likely, but these are the possible adverse events, which are highly improbable, but still possible. And I think it brings out that uncertainty for all of us, that we need the patient to be aware. You know, we're not perfect. Things don't always work out the way we want them to be. And at least this gives us a feel of the percentages of the various outcomes that the patients can then help make their decision.
Moving on to the last two buckets, so looking at intermediate outcome. So again, we're looking at into two different groups, and the majority of patients who achieved an intermediate outcome, the attended effect was not achieved without an adverse effect, and then a smaller number of groups, the attended effect was achieved with an adverse effect. And again, the pattern is, I think, what you would expect, where that pattern was most prevalent in patients with Cushing's disease and least prevalent in patients with prolactinomas. And then again, fortunately, only a small number of patients achieved a poor outcome, which means that the outcome of the surgery was not achieved with a complication. And with that, I will hand it back over to Chase to go over the discussion section.
Thanks, Katie. So now we're really going to focus, even though we went through those numbers, we're really going to think about how they were presented. And so the main point that the authors make in their discussion is talking about this new paradigm, this new system. So they say that it introduces a novel way to classify and present patient-relevant integrated outcomes of surgery. And so they suggest, as we've talked about already, that it is a flexible system, that normally you might have some difficulty comparing Cushing's disease and acromegaly. Other than that, it is pituitary disease, but in this system, you can do that at least a little bit easier. And the other point that they, main point that they make, is that this really uncovers two intermediate outcome groups. And so one of them, that this quadrant that they have described as intended effect at a cost, so you accomplish what you hope to, but there's a complication, and that actually helps you identify a scenario that may be acceptable to patients, as we gave an example before. And then that third quadrant of what they would describe as a no harm done, which is what you tried surgery, it didn't work, but nothing bad happened from it. And they would say that that may be a group to where an additional intervention may result in achieving an intended effect in the future. So what I wanted to touch on briefly as a group is this idea of lumping this together. And the authors, the argument that they make here is to say, we don't have a lot of these patients. None of these diseases that we're talking about are incredibly common. And so if we just narrowly define it to each unique characteristic, there's no way that we're ever going to understand what the best way to think about these folks are. That if we want to have significant power to compare groups and do research studies, we've got to do some sort of lumping like this to get a sufficient end. And so I'm interested in Ashley and Katie, in your thoughts on that. Does that seem a realistic argument? Would you buy into that, or concerned that there's too much lumping, too much grouping together of patients that are quite different from each other?
I think one has to be fair in this situation, and I sympathize with them. I sympathize with us because these are not very common patients, even in a major center. And if you're going to make any sort of comparison, there has to be some sort of lumping, absolutely. As long as you've got the different disease categories and the size of the tumor, I think that's about as far as you can go. Of course, if you then start finding differences over time or between departments or different groups, then you can drill down and then you can go back and find out what were the adverse consequences in this group that wasn't present in the other group. Equally, you know, the complications, as you rightly point out, or even adverse events, curing a patient from Cushing's disease, which untreated has a very high mortality, but allowing them to have desmopressin for their mild diabetes insipidus seems to be a very fair trade-off. And there are other types of adverse events like lifelong hydrocortisone replacement, which are much more serious. So clearly that lumping is not perfect, but I think it's what we could use, and it would allow us then later on to drill into those groups if we start finding differences.
Yeah, I do think it's helpful for a center to help them track their outcomes. I think one piece that may be a little bit problematic would be lumping Cushing's disease patients and acromegaly patients with patients that are having surgery with prolactinomas.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, I completely agree. No. These are completely different animals and you can't lump them. So no, it has to be disease specific. And I would also add, as I said right at the beginning, a further category of non-functioning pituitary adenomas. And what I would also do, looking at those, is compare the outcomes possibly using that grade in a slightly modified form for those who are operated and those who are not operated in order to compare outcomes. So now clearly this has to be disease specific. You can't compare acromegaly with Cushing's disease. It's apples and pears. They're just different beasts.
Good. And so I think you guys have set us up already for the point that the authors make of, well, what are you going to do with this? Okay, so this is a new novel way. Why do we need a new novel way? And they suggest two different major reasons for that you guys have already alluded to. One is that if you have this paradigm, then you can figure out, okay, what are the drivers? What makes somebody end up in quadrant one versus four or two or three? And then if you can clearly do that, then you can much better do that preoperative counseling and to say, based on everything that we know about you, I'm worried that you're going to end up in quadrant four, so I'm not sure that surgery makes much sense for you. So they say that's one of the main reasons why you would want an outcome square approach like this. And the other one, which Katie mentioned, is that you can compare centers. So if you can all get on the same page, if you can agree on the definitions to where you're all talking about the same thing here, then you can compare and patients can have a better sense of where's the best place for me to go. Centers who are underperforming can identify that and then hopefully figure out what they can do to improve. But I think a real key thing here, and I want to get Ashley's input, is you have to agree on definitions. So this group's laid out some, but you could easily see another group say, maybe what Ashley said is, no, we shouldn't be lumping all these patients. They've got to be completely disease specific and we need a different approach. So Ashley, as you think about it, you've worked in different centers, you've seen how different centers interact. How hard is it for totally different groups, often internationally, to get on the same page and agree on definitions?
Well, as you imply, extremely difficult. Everyone publishes their best data and they publish it in a way that they think looks most appropriate. And if it comes from surgeons without a sort of group approach, they can obviously try and, I wouldn't say spin it, but make it look as encouraging as possible, which is entirely reasonable. So I think having some sort of unified approach, but disease specific, I think is hopeful. And I think the criteria they use are, going through them very carefully, not unreasonable for us to use. I would say it's not going to be difficult. I mean, at their 6-week and 3-month follow-up or 6-month follow-up, they can then apportion a given patient with a given disease and surgery with a given surgeon, if you like, into a group. And over time, these will accumulate and we'll be able to look at those very carefully and then be able to say, this particular department is not quite the same as that one. And then you can drill down and say, why are these failures? What are the ones that didn't do well? I think it was you implied before. And then you close that audit loop by going back to your future patients by saying, well, in your particular case, because of our experience and others, we don't think surgery is appropriate in this particular instance because of the nature of your tumor, your age, your comorbidities, or whatever. So I think it will be helpful, but only in a very general manner. Because I think, in a sense, we're all using these squares in our own brains anyway, but just not in such a formalized manner.
We'll come to that here in just a second of, is this going to change what we do? First, the authors do mention some limitations, so they do a good job there. So that they point out that they're a tertiary care center, and so that some of their results may not be applicable to others. So there may be a referral bias in the sense that they perhaps see more complicated patients than some other centers, but then also that they may have more experienced surgeons in other places, so may limit the applicability there. Relatively small sample size, so as we have talked about, that is unavoidable with these conditions. That there is some heterogeneity in patient groups. They do point out that they had a fairly high number of microprolactinomas, so more than most surgical groups would report on intervening on surgically. Any other thoughts, Ashley, Katie, limitations as far as how applicable these findings would be to other centers and other patient groups?
From a European perspective, I think we're all broadly comparable in major centers. You know, I know the people at this center. What they're doing is very broadly in line with what we've been doing in the UK, and I suspect in other places, Italy, Germany, Spain, etc. So I think from that point of view, I don't have a problem with the way these data are presented or how generally applicable they are. I don't know how you feel in the US.
Yeah, to me, I would say from our perspective, very similar. I would agree with something they point out, particularly with the microprolactinomas, fairly uncommon, I would say, at least at our center here with surgically intervening. They point that out, so they acknowledge that that's a little bit unusual. Absolutely. But I would certainly agree from our experience here at Vanderbilt that would be the case as well.
I mean, there has been a slight move back to surgery. And I came into this area when all the patients were operated on a long time ago, and there is a slight pulling back. to operating on maybe a high percentage of patients than we previously did. But the vast majority of microprolactinomas end up on a dopamine agonist like cabergoline.
Yeah, no, I agree with that as well, too. I mean, the authors do point out that that was also the result of a study that they were doing,
that's
specifically
right,
looking at microprolactinomas in terms, yes, of their explanation. But that would be the major difference, certainly, from our center in terms of how they were operating and which patients they were operating on. And then we already touched on previously just looking at the changes in terms of surgical volume over time is potentially being a limitation as well, too.
Good. So we've already talked a little bit about our sense of the quality of this report, and I think have been impressed, obviously, as Ashley pointed out, a really great group here and has presented not just good data, but really a new way of presenting the data and a lot to think about is whether we should be moving that way. So where I'd like us to end, and we'll start with Katie, and then we'll get Ashley's thoughts, or say, do we think this is ready? So we get this presentation of the data and say, yeah, I mean, this is very obvious. We need to be moving. All of our centers need to do this. Or would you say, I'm not sure. Maybe we need a validation of this. Maybe other people need to at least try this and publish on it to see how well it works in other centers. Or, Ashley pointed this out, maybe it's like, is this really going to help clinical care directly? Or are we kind of already doing this informally and this is really just going to help research studies because they need that formal component of it? Potentially other questions as well. So, Katie, give us your thoughts. Would you be ready to advocate for a change in the way that we do things or no, and why?
Yeah, and I don't think it's really a change in the way that we do things, but I think it does give a language to what we're already doing. So, I mean, we're already doing this. We're already having a conversation with the patient and the neurosurgeon about how likely we think it is that the patient's going to have a complete resection or what is the chance of remission, how likely it is that the patient is going to need additional interventions after the surgery. So I like that this gives a kind of a language to that. And I could see how there would be some utility, at least at the center level, to help you track your own patient outcomes.
I agree. I don't think it alters a great deal what we actually do at the moment. And the thing I do like about it is that it's looked like a fairly simple thing to do. So if one is keeping a note of the data as they come through in terms of adverse events, complications, remission rates, I'm always very much averse to anything being added to our already rather busy lives and everything else that it involves. But this would probably only take a few minutes to actually add to the patient's chart. And it will then allow you some sort of objective measure that you can use over time. So I'm not totally wholehearted saying, yes, we're going to do this tomorrow. It's absolutely wonderful, mother, apple pie and all the rest of it. But it gives one some idea that you could objectify what you are doing and that may be useful in the long term.
And with that, I would like to thank Katie Gutenberg and Ashley Grossman for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I know you all learned a great deal as I did and hope that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.